So this week, what we're going to do is, Lord willing, finish up Genesis chapter 47, which will mean we have exactly how many chapters left in Genesis?
Three.
Okay, everybody passed that part of the ordination test. We got 50 chapters in Genesis. And what we're going to have a little hiatus, which we'll talk about in a moment. But Matthew's going to come and share with us. And I just reflect on, you know, some of Mark's comments this morning as he shared how great a blessing it is to have in this church men that can carry the word. And I'm thankful that Matthew can step in, and you'll be, I think, blessed with his teaching on sanctification over these 4 weeks. And I can kind of do my final hunker down as I head towards the finish line of ordination. I'm looking forward to listening to what he has to say, so that when he quizzes me on sanctification during the ordination, I'll make sure that I can answer the questions that he'll bring up correctly. So we'll Lord willing, get through this today, and then after that, we'll wrap up our time in Genesis and talk a little bit today about where we might go next in our study. So Genesis 47, kind of opening thoughts, a few short verses now to sum up the final 2 years of the famine. So remember how I've always said that in Hebrew narrative, you know, you have kind of these long buildups, right? You kind of reach a climax, and then boom, it falls off the cliff in terms of, right, the anticlimax. Well, we're kind of see this whole saga now of Joseph wrapping up in these verses in this chapter, and it's going to cover the final 2 weeks of the final 2 years of the famine. We have the legacy of Joseph's leadership through his 14 years of feast and famine. So I think sometimes we lose sight of the fact of how long this has been going on. And it breaks out this way. Verses 13 to 19 record Joseph's leadership over the final 2 years of the famine. So we see some additional things that Joseph does as he continues to care for and supply for the people. In verses 20 to 26, we get a summary outcome of the 7 years, kind of a recap of everything that happened, along with a statute that was in place to this day. So it was kind of a permanent statute that happened at the end of all this. And then in verses 27 to 31, the narrative turns back to Jacob. And Jacob is going to dominate the final three chapters of Genesis as we close out his patriarchy. But here, kind of dealing first with his plea for his burial, kind of as he starts to make provision for his death that he knows is coming. So, having resettled the family with the possession in the land and the food, we return in verse 13 to the ongoing famine that is being experienced. And this contrast between the provision for Israel or the family and really the Egyptians' need. So we have kind of a bit of a contrast in the two. Now in verse 13, we're entering the sixth year of the famine. Now how do we know that? How do we know we're in the sixth year here?
It's 2 years left.
Okay. That's good. You must have been a math major. You were your math major? There we go. Okay, so note at the end of verse 17, right? We get in the beginning of 18, we know that the famine was 7 years, and we know that this is covering the final 2 years of that. So they're entering into the sixth year of the famine. Now, verse 13 also tells us the extent of the famine, at this case anyway, or the reach, and that was in Egypt and Canaan, which probably suggests at this point that Canaan was underneath the dominion of Egypt at this particular time in history. And reflecting on that historically, you know, the whole land of Canaan, that little spit of land between north and south, has really been a seesaw throughout all of history, both then and now. So the control of Canaan has fluctuated throughout history between times when Israel was its own sovereign nation, and most dominant period of that was in Kings, right? Is that about where you guys are in your reading, Katie, in Kings? In Kings, okay, so you're seeing kind of the highlight of the nation of Israel, at least in its earlier stages in the book of Kings, through the unified monarchy of Saul, David, and Solomon. So there were periods of time when they actually were in control, and they controlled their own destiny, and they sovereignly controlled their nation. But it also fluctuated back and forth between Egypt in the south and Babylonia and Assyria in the north, who were dominating the country, and they were vassal states. Also through time, as we get into the New Testament, we see Greece and Rome, obviously, you know, exercising dominion over the nation of Israel. And then we have today modern day Israel, right? And its interactions with the surrounding Arab nations. So, you know, it is interesting to me, you know, when people say, well, what's going on in the Middle East? It's kind of like, what do you mean what's going on in the Middle East? What's been going on ever since they wrote the Bible? I mean, it's all playing out exactly as God said it would be. But it's also amazing to me to see this little nation, Israel, right? If we don't need any better testimony to God's sovereignty or his preservation through providence, if you will, than what you see in the nation of Israel, right? I mean, you look around that little nation, and there's no reason you would think that they could survive with all those Arab influences and coming down on them, but yet God preserves that and preserves that nation, and obviously we'll see it become the seed or the seat of all power at Christ's return. But it is interesting to kind of see how it's been a seesaw back and forth throughout history. And frankly, much of the seesaw due to what? Israel's own apostasy, exactly the word I was looking for, their disobedience, okay? So all of the Pentateuch basically sets up what God has given them. You get to the end of Deuteronomy, Moses makes his final appeal. He has a very simple appeal. He gives them two options, right? What's option A? What's that?
Follow the
Lord, right? Obey and be good. What's the other one? Disobey and get hammered, okay? Which one do they choose? Disobey and get hammered. Which one do we choose all the time? You know, it's crazy. I guess Mark used the bug to lights analogy this morning. I just want to let you guys know I listen to the message. That's why I throw a few of these things in here. But you know, it is kind of like we're like bugs to lights, right? I mean, we just love to go toy with disaster. And so through that history, we've seen that in Israel. Now, the first 5 years of the famine had exhausted the people's cash reserves, okay? So they'd spent all their cash, none left. And Joseph had dutifully accepted payment, right? And it tells us that he had deposited the money that he received in Pharaoh's treasury. So what should we note about Joseph's actions in doing this? What do you see in Joseph in this?
Wisdom.
Yeah, wisdom for sure. Absolutely. What other kind of attributes do you see in him?
Honesty.
I mean, Jiminy. First of all, the Egyptians we see were expected to pay for the grain. Okay, so even though he saved it up and took it as a tax, it wasn't going to be a free handout. You know, I'm not going to get into social issues, but it is kind of interesting when you think about, you know, charity, government charity, and people really do want to earn and work for what they receive. So first of all, he's that. But then secondly, his integrity, right? Never a hint of what? Dollar for Pharaoh, dime for me. Dollar for Pharaoh, dime for me. Because it's pretty clear that Pharaoh would not have missed any of the loose change, okay? So we see just this honesty and integrity. I think if we're looking for a good definition of above reproach as we're evaluating men that might be leaders in the church, I'm pretty sure Joseph would probably qualify. You know, certainly above reproach in terms of how he dealt with what was put in his hand. Now, so the dollars are exhausted. The starving Egyptians appeal to Joseph in verse 15, essentially saying, we're out of cash. Are you going to let us die? So what's Joseph's response in verse 16? What's his response?
No, here's another way.
Yeah, here's another way, okay? So he gives them, says he accepts payment in the form of their livestock, right? Now, here's an interesting thought. Does this seem like a harsh or malintended thing? Or is this actually an act of kindness on Joseph's part to take the livestock in payment?
Act of kindness.
Okay, why?
Because if they don't have the grain for themselves, they don't have it for the animals.
Absolutely. It's good to have you back. Here you go, firing off the questions. Exactly right, okay? It is an act of kindness, and it's an act of kindness because they would have had to feed their livestock. They would have had to care for the livestock. They're already struggling to have enough food for themselves, so he's acting again benevolently to supply food. And in taking the livestock, he then would be expected to supply the food to keep the livestock alive. Okay, so another act there. Now, how might we know that the Egyptians saw it this way? How can we kind of tell from the text that the Egyptians saw it this way?
Verse 17.
Yeah, what's it say?
They brought their livestock to Joseph. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any hesitation in doing that.
Yeah, absolutely right. Okay, because they brought up the request of it, no grumbling, no resentment, no, you know, kind of, ah, that's a bad deal, can't I keep a couple of the lambs, you know? No, they just brought them to him and said, that's fine, okay? So, simple observation. Now, how long was this supply of food intended to last?
A year.
Okay, so I got 1 year and I got 2 years. Which one? How many want to do one? How many that don't want to get it wrong want to reconsider one? Okay, 1 year, okay? It tells us in the text this is intended for 1 year, right? Note the last part of verse 17. So this is, again, he's taking the famine year by year, okay? Again, I think it's prudent in his case. He's parceling out only what they need for a period of time so they don't get, you know, greedy and start eating it up and not have anything left for the period of time afterwards. Now, so 1 year later, they're back at the food bank, right? They're out of food, back at the food bank. And now what's different about the negotiations for this last year? What's different about the negotiations in the last year? They are offering themselves. That's certainly the outcome, okay?
A sense of panic versus recovery.
Yeah, kind of sense of panic and so forth. That's right. And then the other kind of subtle thing is the terms are proffered by them, okay? So they're offering the solution this final year, okay? And I think he wisely lets them take the lead. Now, why would it be wise for him to let them take the lead at this point in time on this kind of final payment for food in that seventh year? Yeah, exactly right. Okay, you got it going. That's exactly right. I mean, I think the key thing is that they are now going to offer themselves, right? Now, if he had said, well, I'm going to enslave you, that's how you're going to pay for the last year. But no, they came forward and said, we'll take that action. So what is their offer? Themselves and their land, okay? So notice they're offering both themselves and their land. And what is interesting about the question in verse 19?
Why should you die before your eyes, first me and our land?
Okay, yeah.
Because they don't want to die and they don't want to starve yet. Because
right.
They want to eat and be lived.
Yeah. Okay, so yeah, that's the first part, but it's not only appeal for them, but what? The land as well, okay? So they're appealing both for neither themselves nor, if you will, the land to die. Jack?
Land essentially given to them.
What's that?
Wasn't the land essentially given to them by the Egyptians in the first place?
Probably was, yeah, probably. Could it be returning it? I don't know. I didn't do enough research in the past as to whether they had that kind of system in place before. But either it had been parceled out by them, but it could have been given out as a possession, just as he gave out the land as a possession to the priests, where they actually owned it. So they might have been given a portion, but at this point, I think they owned the portion, okay? And now they're giving back the ownership of that portion is kind of what we're seeing happening at this time. So the appeal is for both themselves and the land, and what do they request? Well, food to eat and seed to plant. Okay, yeah. Roger.
I got a question. This is occurring in both Egypt and in Canaan.
Right.
So does that mean that all the Canaanites, including Joseph's family, are offering themselves up as being slaves for food?
Yeah, I think the way I would think that through, first of all, we know that Joseph and his family are not, because they're given a possession. We'll see that in just a second, okay? So just like the priests, they are given a possession and given food, and that was already agreed to. I expect that if we went back and looked at historical records, that Canaan was already a vassal state of Egypt, okay? So they didn't have anything to give. They were already under Egypt's control. So this is the Egyptians per se,
okay.
I think, in focusing on them and their possessions. Canaan's just kind of a carry-along because they're under their control and they would have already forfeited anything they had in terms of Egypt conquering them at that point in time, okay? So they ask for food to eat and seed to plant, and I just think it's interesting to me to see that they're still trying to provide for themselves, okay? So they clearly want to be able to care for themselves, provide for themselves. They don't want to be in a welfare state. Matthew?
Some of the unresolved questions I have is... Obviously, Joseph saw this coming, and he installed a new tax. Did the people not then also save some store off for themselves, except give the 20% of their own grain? Now, here you are, fast forward 7 years later, and he's giving back to them what they have given to him
right.
in exchange for their failure to take heed, because this is something that the reason why he stored the grain, because he knew this was coming, and we're going to wind up doing, let's make 7 years from now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Kind of like the way our country operates, right?
When the government says, I'm here to help you.
Well, yeah. You do. I mean, you know, we're not going to get into a political debate, but I mean, small government is a good thing, right? Big government, bigger in government. I mean, you know, just look at, if you look at 1 Samuel 8, when Israel requests the king, what you'll remember is the caution that he goes back and gives them is what? Three things. He's going to take your best people, he's going to take your cash, and he's going to conscript you into serving in the army and so forth. So as you start to create a centralized government structure, right, you're going to start to create that wheel turning. And yeah, you're right. I mean, he was wise enough to take from them, but, you know, he didn't take excessively. I mean, I think we'd all be pretty happy with a flat 20% tax.
So they didn't save not for themselves either.
Right.
So they believed in small government, but they're thinking it's small-minded government.
Yeah, right. So they go through that process. Okay, so it is interesting, though, the whole process and the attitude. Yeah, Roger.
But didn't they go through this 45 years without getting food from Joseph?
No. Joseph's been distributing food all through the 5 years. Yeah, absolutely. If we go back and look at the record, you'll see he's been distributing food year by year. You know, as the famine struck and they weren't getting anything out of their farming proceeds, they were coming to him for food, and they were able to pay for that, you know, with cash tender at that point in time. So now it's gotten so severe that they're going through other scenarios. So
I just have a question that strikes me as strange, but maybe it's because I come from farmland in Illinois, but they had livestock. Why were they starving? I'd be giving me, get me a steak.
Well, they might have been some pretty scrawny looking cows, you know, so who knows how long they'll last. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good kind of unresolved questions in our mind. Well, how have the livestock been surviving all this time? Well, apparently, obviously, he's been giving out enough for them and for their livestock. Yeah, why haven't they been eating the livestock? I don't know. Maybe they were. Okay. Yeah, so, you know, you get too much meat, you got too high protein a diet, and then you're in trouble there, too.
Well, I've never heard of the Egyptian barbecue.
Yeah, right. Argentinian barbecue, I imagine, but no Egyptian barbecue. Yeah, so surely they could have done that. Okay, so how often people want to give up in hopeless pursuit, right? That's a hopeless point. Now, what does all this suggest about how they view Joseph? Just kind of reiterating the same point. I'd say they see him as fair, having no ulterior motive in what he's doing, right? So they've never, ever in this process objected to what Joseph has asked for. Not sure how they really could have, right? You know, given that they needed the food, but there could have been a rebellion. There could have been a number of different things. And who's this foreigner in here kind of dictating how we do things? So I think one of the remarkable things about Joseph, and I've mentioned this from time to time before, is in spite of all his kind of ascendancy that he's achieved, no one ever seems to begrudge him, right? So I think he just shows really, you know, terrific leadership. You know, what kind of leader would be great? And you can see that just a second. And, you know, you're happy to have them there, and you see that. Yes, sir.
Didn't that the Israelites already have their flocks and herds under their control because they brought them to them to take care of?
Yeah, they did. So who knows? Maybe they had the one special oasis that was back up there. So again, remember, this account is all focusing more on the Egyptians, okay? The Israelites have been preserved by God in this process. They've been planted, you know, in the Nile Valley, which if there's going to be any fertile land and grazing land, it's going to be there, right? So who knows what the famine was? Was the famine some kind of pestilence he brought out? Was it a lack of rain? I mean, I don't know. We're not told in the Bible, but clearly, yeah, they've been maintained through that process. And who knows? Perhaps, you know, Jacob had been a bit wiser, you know, not knowing there was a famine coming, but maybe he had built storehouses of his own when they were having plenteous harvest back in Canaan and so forth. So again, there's a lot that we're not told about how that's really happened in there, but the focus here is on what's happening in Egypt and how they're kind of moving through that scenario. Okay, so somebody read 20 to 26 for me, please.
So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every Egyptian sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. Thus the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them to the cities from one end of Egypt's border to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had an allotment from Pharaoh, and they lived off the allotment which Pharaoh gave them. Therefore they did not sell their land. And Joseph said to the people, "Behold, I have today bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is seed for you, and you may sow the land. And at your harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh, and four-fifths shall be your own for seed of the field, and for your food, and for those of your households, and as food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's slaves." And Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, valid to this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth. Only the land of the priests did not become Pharaoh's.
Okay, so Joseph completes the land acquisition in verse 20, and then he makes a wise decision in verse 21. What's the decision he makes in verse 21? Just read it.
He moves them
all to the city. Okay. Now, we probably can't relate to this here in America, but I know both Kayin and Katie can relate to this. If you look at China, what's happened in China over the years is they have been migrating people out of the countryside into the cities. Now, not necessarily for good purposes there. It's more of a government control scenario. But he relocates the people to the cities, and he's doing this, I think, although the text is not explicit, for a couple reasons. Number one, it's easier to care for the people and watch over the people. Now, obviously, he's probably left somebody in the countryside. And then secondly, to make the administration of the food distribution easier, right? So remember, it said earlier that he'd built storehouses in various different places. So he was kind of consolidating people around the distribution centers. Maybe they went out to the field from day to day or whatever they did. But by bringing it all together, he's made the administration of the process easier. This said, I can't really explain why he didn't do it sooner in the 7 years. It seemed like it would have been wise, but for whatever reason, this is the way that God worked it out. So continuing, we learn in verse 22 that in addition to Joseph's family, only the priests were exempted. Okay, so two groups of people still had a possession in the land. Joseph and his family was given a permanent possession in Goshen, and the priests were also given a permanent possession that was never taken away. Okay, so we have just two groups of people in there that have their own possession. Unless we think of the Egyptians as slaves in the Western context, we should note that what he's really establishing here is a feudal system. Right? The feudal system was active throughout Europe for many, many years. How do we surmise this? By the fact that essentially a tax, and a reasonably fair one at that, was implemented. Okay, so he's owned the land. Not a new concept, very common, reasonably fair. A noble or king owned the land, right? Serfs were given access to the land in return for protection and other services. They farmed the land and paid an annual crop tax. So through much of medieval Europe, this was the actual system that was used, and it was an effective system for doing things. Now, this may not sound appealing to our Western minds, but it was a common and fruitful form of governance historically. Now, the ultimate proof, what is the ultimate proof the Egyptians trusted Joseph's administration? And so what do we see in this text here as we read through it? How do we see that they really trusted Joseph's administration? How do they characterize him in when he has instituted this? Yeah, what's it say? Exactly right. So they viewed him as a savior of sorts in a temporal sense, right, and a material sense. So they see him as somebody who has interceded for them in somewhat of a benevolent fashion and cared for them through this difficult period of time. So again, we see this remarkable quality in Joseph to ascend to these levels of leadership and power, and yet no corruption enters into him, and he's viewed and perceived as a benevolent leader here, a savior, somebody who saved them. And then we have this final recorded act of Joseph's stewardship, which was to establish this feudal pattern as a permanent statute in Egypt. So if you went back and looked at Egypt history, you could see that this continued on from those periods of time. Okay, 27 to 31, somebody read those?
Question, yeah. The
what's that?
Who are the priests?
When they're, you mean who are they?
Yeah,
Are they
Egyptian
priests?
Oh, yeah. Are they
Israeli priests? Oh, no. These are Egyptian priests to their quote gods, little g, O-D-S, okay? So they had many, many, many gods in Egypt. They had a religious system. You know, and it's a good question, actually, and it brings up a good point. You know, when you're witnessing to somebody, you know, somebody say, well, I'm just not religious. Really? You know, everybody's religious, okay? You know, at some level, there's been religion of all sorts through every period of history and every culture of time. The Egyptians had their cultic system with the sun god and the water god and all these different gods, but the big difference was that they viewed them as something to be feared, who they had to sacrifice to get benevolent treatment, versus the god of the universe, who kind of switches that whole thing and that whole model and so forth. So, you know, the point of it is everybody at some level is operating with some level of religion. Now, science could be their religion, okay? I'm picking on science. Science is good. There's a lot of good things that come out of science, and we've learned a lot of things, and it helps us discover about God's creation. But somebody, everybody has something that we kind of idolize and we're holding on to, and we hear, see, that these were their priests. They had their priest and cultic system, and so they were, you know, held out in that regard. And, you know, they would have appealed to them. The pharaohs would have appealed to the priests at times, you know, differently than the Israelite kings would have, but there was a whole cultic system at that point in time. Okay? All right, somebody read 27 to 31, please.
I got that. Now Israel lived in the land of Egypt, in Goshen, and they acquired property in it and were fruitful and became very numerous. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. When the time for Israel to die drew near, he called his son Joseph and said to him, please, if I have found favor in your sight, place now your hand under my thigh and deal with me in kindness and faithfulness. Please do not bury me in Egypt. For when I lie down with my fathers, you shall carry me out of Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. And he said, swear to me. So he swore to him. And Israel bowed in worship at the head of the bed.
Okay, so we see this kind of plea on Joseph or Jacob's behalf to make sure that he's buried back in his, what he considers to be homeland. We see the same pattern. Where did you see this pattern of swear an oath and put the hand under the thigh? Where did we see that earlier? In the book?
With Abraham and his servant, Eliezer.
Yeah, very good. That's excellent. You weren't even here for that, and you remember that. Much better. So yeah, exactly, was a form of taking an oath, and obviously I guess because of the, you know, personal nature of that is kind of a really strong oath that he's doing, but he wants him to swear an oath to do that. And of course Joseph says, it's kind of interesting, I think Joseph's kind of saying, come on Pop, I don't need to swear an oath, I'll do that. He says, no, swear to me. So he really wants to make sure that he doesn't get buried in Egypt. So we come to this kind of final sense, and as we enter these chapters, we again begin with this contrast between the two peoples, okay? So from 12 to 13, the contrast was one of provision and starvation between Israel and the Egyptian people. In 26 to 27, they're contrasted as a fruitful and free people, right? They acquired land and they were free, and a saved, meaning not saved salvifically, but saved in terms of having food, but bound people who lost their property. So it's kind of interesting, right? What do we see as a contrast? I mean, God does preserve his people, and he also elevates his people in the process of that preservation. So we see that sovereign hand in the process. So we start in on that process. We see the beginnings of the great multitude promised to Abraham, right? So this is the final part of the promise. You know, they'd seen many, many parts of it. This is the part that all of the patriarchs kept questioning all along. Where's the kids? Where's the kids? Where's the kids? Well, here's the kids, okay? So they're starting to see a great multitude. They're reproducing here and becoming a greater nation, which is intriguing and almost a hallmark of God. And the hallmark that I'm pointing to here is that he chooses to work in what I think we might see typically as odd circumstances. You know, God does work in very odd circumstances. Yet we often see him accomplishing his work in unlikely circumstances. So can you think of some kind of general examples of that, where you've seen, where we see God work in unusual circumstances? What are some broad categories of that? You start.
I think with Paul.
Yeah, certainly with Paul. That's a great one, right? You know, the biggest persecutor of the Gentiles and the believers, and he turned them into the greatest evangelist at that point in time. That's one great example, yeah. So, other ones, what can you think of?
I am always blown away by Peter.
Yeah, interesting, right? So who did he pick for the 12? The best and the brightest, the top guys out of the Pharisaical school and Sadducetical school? No, a bunch of fishers and farmers. Matthew.
This is a personal example. When my dad was still living, he fell down when he was up north, slipped on some ice, hurt his shoulder. He comes back here, he has an x-ray just before surgery, and they find a spot on his lung, and they wound up removing his lung instead. That's how God, in his mercy,
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, very good example of those kind of things. And mercy on those who are believers and unbelievers. I mean, God sends the rain on, you know, the saved and the unsaved. I mean, God has a general grace that he pours out on everybody, and a very special grace on those who are drawn to saving faith. Okay, so those are some examples. What else can you think of? Jack. Hold on a sec, Jack. Yeah, absolutely. Romans 13, right? God gave us government as a means to provide peace and, you know, stability and things. Dan?
I just said, how about the incarnation? That's pretty
important. Yeah, how about that? There's a great example, right? I didn't have that one there. There's about, okay, so you humbled himself, right? He's a little carpenter, yet he changed the world. So, you know, in the midst of heavy persecution, God works. I mean, I saw that in China in terms of how he brought people to faith. And, you know, it just... Persecution is a refining fire of God. I mean, you just see that. You see that in the Middle East and the Arab world today, and people coming to faith there. In obscure places, right? God works in very obscure places. And then the one kind of generally in unlikely people. You brought up Paul. You brought up Peter. What about us? Right? You know, I'm going to have the pleasure of the pulpit next week, and we're going to do Psalm 8. And I'll tell you now, what's the title? What is man? Right? I mean, what in the world is God doing that he's using these, Matthew prayed it at the end, earthen vessels, right? And to accomplish his purposes, right? I mean, it's overwhelming when you stop and think about it. And I just love the question that the psalmist poses. What is man? So look forward to that. We'll see what happens next week with the rest of that one. So Jacob lived another 17 years in Egypt under Joseph's care, which is a bit ironic, because that's the number of years that Joseph had lived under Jacob's care before he went back to Haran. So sensing his final days, Jacob has one pressing concern. What's his pressing concern? Do not bury me down here, right? Don't bury me in Egypt. Now, why this concern of all things? I mean, why is this the most central thing? Right? In that time, when a patriarch was dying, the biggest concern would have been the blessing, which we're going to again, of course, see in the next couple of chapters. But why this particular concern?
Could it be because of the millennial kingdom was promised to them, and that's, of course, different land altogether?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I think we're going to have to go through some sanctified speculation. Okay, the text doesn't really say. I think Matthew's got one idea about that, and that is that he does, in fact, see and remembers the promises of the land, okay, and knows that's where God's going to carry out his purposes, and he wants to be back in there. So he may have been concerned, also, kind of one speculation, with the burial he might have received in Egypt, right? I mean, burials in Egypt for big shots was a big deal, right? So would he necessarily want to be honored? And he would have been honored that way as Joseph's father, likely by Pharaoh. Okay, so maybe he didn't want that pomp and circumstance to send the wrong message. A lot of pomp and circumstance, but I think that's probably tertiary motive. Second, and more probable, is to reflect his faith in God's promises, which is what Matthew said. Namely, to be buried in the land of promise, what Jacob considered home. Okay? Suggesting that Jacob preferred the promises of God over the acclaim of the world. Right? And that really is a good reminder for us, isn't it? I mean, what do we value more? How does Paul say it? You know, I count these momentary afflictions as nothing for the surpassing future that I have in Christ Jesus, right? So do we really look at life that way? We do see, I think, the character of that in Jacob here. So he sees the promises of God, the future, the covenant promises as more important than the acclaim of the world. And then thirdly, which I think is probably really more to be, if you will, I think is an important object lesson to the new generation. Okay, so if you remember, Numbers, as you go through the process, kind of a three-part structure to Numbers. You know, they took them out of their preparation for the journey. They were in the wilderness, and then the last part of Numbers is the reordering of the new generation before they entered the land. Right? Why was that? The other guys had all died, right? As God told them they would in the wilderness. Okay, so now they're reordering the new generation. I think there's some sense here that as the new generation had been brought up in Egypt, had not been brought up in the land, that there's a bit of an object lesson or to impress upon this new generation of people that your future is not here. Okay, it's not here. It's back in the land of Canaan. So, rather, they're sojourners and their covenant promises lie in Canaan, and a burial in the ancestral cemetery, the cave at Machpelah, which is where his father was buried, would forcibly make this point or vividly make this point to them. Okay? So Joseph readily agrees to Jacob's request, which he secures by demanding an oath from Jacob. And we saw that earlier because we've already covered that. We won't again, but this was the same process that he had done with his servant. Was it Gehazi or was it? I can't remember exactly. It was
Eleazar's
servant. Okay, you remember better. Who was Gehazi? That was another servant later. Okay, but so with Eleazar. So the same form of an oath and swearing an oath in the process. So upon securing Joseph's oath, Jacob closes the first stage of preparing for the end of worship. And, you know, it's interesting that I think one of the distinct privileges of growing older is the privilege of reflecting, right? Kind of the looking back on things. Reflection's an interesting thing. And when I reflect, my mind kind of wanders in one of two directions. I either reflect in regret, which I can almost always, not almost always, I can't always pinpoint as something that I have done or something that I have traced that I have done. So we can also kind of think in terms of kind of regretful tones. But we can also think in terms of rejoicing, which as I reflect in a rejoicing fashion, I can say almost always points to what God has done in my life and our various different lives. So, you know, you kind of reflect on those things. You think of things that maybe you would have liked to have done better or differently. But then we also have the opportunity to rejoice on those things. And if we're honest with ourselves, that rejoicing is generally something that we look back to in terms of what God has done in our lives. Things I'd never want to change, to which the only right response is worship, right? Worship. And you think of the Psalms, I mean, it's worship. It's a personal response to the person and work of God. You see those kinds of things. There are many things that old age can take away from us, but worship is not one of them. You know, I think one of the greatest gifts of us as seasoned saints is the fact that we can pray and we have time to pray. We've got some particular prayer warriors in this room. I wish all of us were more prayer warriors at times, but the fact of the matter is it's something you can always do. Always you can be praying, and as you have time to do that. So I think this is what we see here in Jacob's final days. He's bowing in worship, and that's kind of what's recorded in the text, which is in fact corroborated, okay, as the greatest expression of Jacob's faith. So turn to Hebrews. Okay, we have that great hall of faith in chapter 11, right? Kind of goes through and reflecting. This is a reflection section on the faith of the saints of old, that great cloud of witnesses that we should look back to. And in chapter 11, verse 21, we see one little verse here about Jacob. And it says, "By faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, and what? Worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff." Now, it's interesting to me, or fascinating, that of all the things the writer of Hebrews could have chosen to characterize Jacob's faith, what he focuses in on was his worship, right? So I think it helps us understand just how important worship is. So a little preview again next week, Psalm 8. If anybody's got that psalm in their heart, you know how it starts, right? O Lord, our Lord, what? How majestic is your name in all the earth. What's that? Well, that's worship. Now, we could do one whole sermon on just that verse, but we won't because we have to do communion next week too. All right? But the fact of the matter is that it's all about worship, and it's interesting that that's what he chooses to reflect on. So the one he chooses is a reasonably obscure set of events, the focus of which is worship, which really should not surprise us, right? And in the interest of time, I'll let you read Revelation chapter 4 on your own. But when you get that preview of heaven, right? So Revelation, our end time events, we start off with the revelation of Christ. We get the letters to the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3. 4 to 5, we get the preparation for the tribulation period. What do we see? What scene in heaven is John exposed to? What does he see? Worship, worship, worship. Holy, holy, holy. Singing, singing, singing. Okay? Worship. So you want to know what you're going to be doing in heaven? Go back and read chapter 4. Worship. Okay? We'll be able to worship, and we'll be able to worship him in ways that we just can't today, right? But it'll be a wonderful expression of that. So burial, the scene in heaven amplifies the fundamental importance of worship. It is what we will continually do. And we find the object of Jacob's rejoicing in worship, as we just look ahead a little bit in chapter 48. So the objective, or his thankfulness, is for this in verse 11. Israel said to Joseph, what? I never expected to see your face, and behold, God has let me see your children as well. So not only did he get to see the son that he thought he had lost, he gets to see the progeny that issued from that son. So God in his grace allowed him to do that. And we should reflect on the rich truth that God has neither left us nor forsaken us. So on that perfect end note, a couple of closing thoughts. We've had this kind of remarkable journey through these chapters of 37 to 47. And looking back, the overall structure of the patriarch has been kind of interesting. Okay, so it started in chapter 27. And in 27 to 36, the primary focus was on Jacob, right? Now, as we move forward in 37 to 47, the focus is on Joseph. And as we conclude the book, we're going to see it return again to Jacob. So you've kind of got these two parentheses and this focus on Joseph in the middle in terms of how God is accomplishing his sovereign plan through Joseph to get the nation to Egypt. And now starting in Genesis 48, the focus goes back to him, which paves the way for an important question for us to contemplate, since we're kind of getting to the end of our Genesis study. What are we going to study next? Oh, you got a suggestion already, Danae, huh?
I've read Exodus. I've read almost not any book, but some scripts of books I've read. Mm-hmm. And I can read Exodus through everything. And there's only one real book I have at home.
Yeah. Right.
Born as a slave by Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And
just ready to move on to Exodus and keep the story.
Well, all I can do is say that great minds do think alike. So just kind of a little preview. As I said, Matthew is going to guide us through the topic of sanctification over the next four Sundays. Don't deny yourself of that wonderful opportunity. Then I'll spend a couple weeks to wrap up Genesis. I wanted to kind of gauge your appetite. As I said to you before, we're not quite a democracy in here, but I would like to get your input in the process. My proposal is this, as Danae has excellently suggested already, that we continue sequentially with Exodus, and I promise you we will not belabor the design of the tabernacle or the building of the tabernacle, which my wife will be angry at me for, but I can't belabor that because it drives me crazy. All those details that I can't figure out, but kind of continue the journey through Exodus and not belaboring the design. But what I want to do is mix in the Psalms that overlap with and speak to certain parts of the Exodus, right? So certain Psalms can be connected to certain other parts of the Bible. There happen to be five of them that most scholars think are speaking to some aspect of the Exodus. So as we come to those chapters, what I'd propose we do is we'll kind of pause and take a look at some of those Psalms. Now, before the first one, I'll probably take a couple, maybe even 3 weeks, to kind of just introduce Hebrew poetry in the Psalms in general. So Hebrew poetry is kind of a fascinating topic. I preached on Psalm 19 a while ago. Thought I was going to do that in 1 week and took three. But the fact of the matter is that kind of understanding how Hebrew poetry works is helpful as you read it. And so I'll kind of start with maybe a couple weeks to just give us a sense of kind of the Psalms in general, how they're organized, what the type of Psalms are that are there, and then how you can look at Psalms, you know, how you read them and understand them in Hebrew poetry, which should give us some periodic breaks from the straight narrative, okay? My thought for the proposal really is this, to reach closure on the nation's story, okay? So if we complete Exodus, we really have kind of completed the story of how God's brought them to the land, how he sent them out of the land, and now how he's brought them back into the land, kind of sets the stage for the rest of the story. And brings us to a nice stopping point for the Pentateuch, unless y'all want to go through the details of the sacrificial system, which I'm happy to do, but I don't think you've got the patience for. There are some interesting things really about the, there are some really interesting cool stuff about the festivals and kind of. What's that?
I think we just voted by a raise of hands.
So we probably won't go that, but it'd be a good breaking point for that. So if you would kind of give this some thought over the next few weeks as we're taking a break from Genesis before we wrap things up, and we can talk about that. If you feel like we need a little foray into the New Testament, because we've kind of been in the Old Testament now for a better part of 2 years. I'm happy to take a little excursus there if there's something that, you know, might be a blessing to you, and then we can get back to the Old Testament as well. Okay, so those are kind of the thoughts on that. Mm-hmm.